The headlines: the Yemeni army says it has shot down an armed aircraft operated by the Saudi coalition engaged in hostile acts over Hajj province. Iran's President Raisi says the Biden administration policies do not differ from those of the Trump administration. And Ukraine and Russia stepping up alerts with 10-day military drills amid the ongoing tensions over NATO's expansion eastward. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Yemeni army says it has shot down another intruding Saudi spy drone. The spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces says it air defenses downed the CH-4 spy aircraft while carrying out hostile acts over Hajj province. Yahya Saadeh adds that the surface-to-air missile targeting the plane has not yet been unveiled. Yemen has brought down tens of drones in the course of Saudi Arabia's seven-year aggression on the country. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread infectious diseases. We've talked to journalist and political commentator Nasser Arabi to get his take on Yemeni forces' latest military achievements. He believes the highlight of the latest operation is the missile that the Yemeni army used to take down the spy drone.
This is something that would change, of course, the dynamics of the war, but it is not the only one. Spy drone that were downed so far. Many spy drones, advanced ones, were downed during this war. But now I think the news today is not downing this drone, but the missile, the surface-to-air missile that targeted this spy drone is the news, which means that this is a good indication that Ansar Allah are keeping an eye on how to develop their weapons, especially the aerial weapons like this kind of missiles to target and to reduce the Saudi superiority in this aerial weapon.
In Tabi's news review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition of the program, just hours ago, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi met with dozens of foreign ambassadors in Tehran on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Well, during his speech at the event, the president drew an analogy between the current and the former U.S. administrations. He said the Biden administration is no different from its predecessor in its policies and actions. The president also talked about Iran's 2015 deal, saying the status quo is the result of Washington's withdrawal and the inaction of other signatories. President Raisi said diplomacy only works when all sides abide by their commitments, and pointing out to the ongoing Vienna talks, he said any negotiation should guarantee Iran's national interests.
We will support any negotiation that guarantees our national interests, in accordance with the fatwa of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Iran is not looking to develop a nuclear weapon. Such weapons that can create a huge devastation and cause massacres have no place in our defense doctrine. We have always said our nuclear activities are peaceful. To clear ambiguities, we even took on commitments beyond the JCPOA as proof of our goodwill. And the International Atomic Energy Agency has repeatedly verified this.
Raisi also spoke about regional issues and highlighted the importance of peace and stability. In West Asia, he said the region's main problem is foreign interference. The president noted that certain world powers have only exacerbated the crisis by supplying deadly weapons to West Asia. Raisi recalled how Daesh terrorists were trying to disrupt regional peace with support from some arrogant powers. He added that Washington's disgraceful withdrawal from Afghanistan proved that the region will not be a safe haven for foreign forces. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Professor, University of Tehran, and political analyst Fuad Izadi, who's with us from the Iranian capital. Also, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Izadi. Iran's President Raisi says that the Biden administration's policies have so far not been so different from those of the Trump administration. Knowing that delegations are back in Vienna to negotiate the revival of the agreement, unpack those comments for us, please.
Well, during the 2020 presidential election, Mr. Biden and some of his advisors were criticizing Trump for exiting the nuclear agreement. And President Biden had the chance to return to the agreement on the first day of his presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accords. But he decided not to do that. And it has been more than a year that he has been in office, and he has been more or less following the same policies of the Trump administration that they truly say that these policies have failed. So the rhetoric is different from what we used to hear during the Trump administration. But the practice is the same, and that is why President Raisi is pointing out to this very fact that as long as the United States levels sanctions on Iran, then Iran doesn't see any difference between Biden and Trump.
Mr. Bosnich, the Iranian president, in his comments, said that the region's main problem is foreign interference. Do you see it in that light as well? And if you can, elaborate on those comments for us as well.
I think that that's pretty well accepted, that there's foreign interference in the affairs, the internal affairs of Iran. And I think that one key word we can refer to here, and I agree with my fellow commentator today, that there's not much difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration on this issue. This is why the word administration actually applies here, because all they are is administrators of the American empire. And therefore, the American empire has its strategic goals, which are largely set by Congress and which are set by the lobbies that control the Congress. And as we know, the Israel lobby is one of the strongest lobbies, if not for sure the strongest in the United States. And so we have two administrations that are strongly beholden to the Israel lobby, which has a priority goal of disrupting affairs in Iran.
Same question to Mr. Izadi as we're on the topic regarding foreign interference in the region. Would you elaborate on those comments made by President Raisi? Our guest in Belgrade says that he sees it in that light as well, and that is an accepted fact with regards to the region.
You know, as President Raisi said today, Iran's foreign policy during his administration is going to focus on regional cooperation, cooperation with the neighboring countries, and cooperation with the countries that like to work with Iran. If that is the goal, then the interference from foreign powers is going to cause difficulties for this policy. The United States, whether it was during the Trump administration, the current administration, Obama administration, governments before, in the last 43 years since the victory of Islamic Revolution, have tried to sabotage Iran's relations with its neighbors. They actually helped Iraq during Saddam's era to attack Iran. So one of the tools that the United States has used in the past is to cause difficulties when it comes to Iran's neighbors and trying to create difficulties in Iran's foreign policy. And that is a historical fact. So what the president is saying is that Iran is interested in working with its neighbors, and that's, as he said, is a strategic decision that Iran has made. It's not a tactical decision. And Iran is going to work very forcefully to combat any attempts from the United States or other countries to cause difficulties for this strategic decision that Iran has made.
Mr. Bozich, Iranian president said his administration's policy is maximum engagement and interaction with other countries, most notably neighboring countries. How would you assess his administration's conduct regarding this policy so far?
Well, they seem to be moving in the correct direction. Obviously, Iran needs to secure proper and fair interactions with its immediate neighbors. And in that way, it not only gains friendship and collaboration and mutual support from those neighbors, it also acquires a kind of buffer zone against American and Israeli-directed intervention in Iranian affairs. And this is a dual positive for Iran, and provided that Iran is able to continue on this course, as it appears to be doing, it is the best possible way to defuse the aggressive tone coming from Washington and the long-term enmity of Israel.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Fouad Izadi, Professor, University of Tehran and Political Analyst, joining us from Tehran. And thanks to journalist John Bozich joining us from Belgrade. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Hundreds of Afghans stuck in a refugee camp in the UAE hold a protest rally to voice their fury at the U.S. for leaving them stranded for months. The Afghans are demanding that the Biden administration relocate them to the United States as soon as possible. They say they feel abandoned and forgotten. Emirati forces have reportedly made a number of arrests during the rally. The protesters are among an estimated 12,000 Afghans who were taken to the UAE amid a chaotic withdrawal of American forces following the Taliban takeover in August. They were supposed to temporarily accommodated in a compound in Abu Dhabi before being taken to the U.S. 6 months on, they're still waiting to hear if they'll be given visas to the states. Ukraine is starting 10-day military drills just as Russia is conducting maneuvers only a few miles away in Belarus. Ukrainian officials say they're holding the drills in response to the Russia-Belarus joint exercises. Kiev says it's using drones and anti-tank missiles provided by its foreign partners. Ukrainian drills will run through the 20th of February. Russia's military exercises with Belarus are also being held during the exact same period. Washington is calling Moscow's drills in Belarus an escalatory action, with NATO saying it's the largest Russian deployment to an ex-Soviet country since the Cold War. The West has been alleging for some time that Russia is preparing to invade Ukraine, but the Kremlin says it has no such plans and that its military buildup on its own soil is because it feels threatened by NATO's eastward expansion.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine, and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount, and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody spend less money on army and more money on compensation, kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Protests in the Canadian capital, Ottawa, against COVID-19 restrictions drag for almost 2 weeks as authorities warn of economic damage to the country. The protesters opposing a vaccine or quarantine mandate for cross-border truckers have also blocked two main crossings to the United States. A key link used to move goods between the two neighbors, known as the Ambassador Bridge, has been shut since Monday night. Another border crossing in Alberta has also been closed Tuesday night. Police have threatened to arrest protesters blocking Ottawa's streets. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the blockades unacceptable and a threat to the enemy. The White House has also warned that the protest action risks hurting the auto industry. India's local elections kick off with voters now heading to the polls in the most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. More than 600 candidates are competing for 58 seats in the first round of the seven-phase vote in the northern state. A total of 400 seats are up for grabs, ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, the main opposition Congress Party. And a host of smaller parties are in the fray in the key battleground that's home to more than 150 million eligible voters. Overall, five states, including Punjab, are set to hold elections this month. The local votes are a key test of the popularity for Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his ruling party before nationwide parliamentary polls due in 2 years. The Hindu Nationalist Party is under criticism for high unemployment, its Hindu First agenda, and its handling of the COVID pandemic. The 1979 Islamic Revolution was meant to fulfill long-cherished desire of independence for Iranians who had suffered decades of subjugation and domination by a monarchical rule with its nexus with some foreign powers. And one of the revolution's main promises was to keep the country away from all forms of dependence, either on the West or the East. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
To congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King, The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Daryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Du, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me they're gonna save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real. I felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you, otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this the context is absolutely critical.
I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know underneath the surface that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's unmasked, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms has been told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean,
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as the chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific, and Darrell Gates. I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years, and so the film goes over. You know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs, and it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is, you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it, but you know, you go, okay, well then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now again,
that
doesn't excuse
it,
but it's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And Serge, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated, people are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying it. I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like South, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. And they used a lead-gauge baton to kill him in 1979. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that.
Yes.
That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American. Mm-hmm. It's a very, you know, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. you know, with 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual sort of... you know, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and, you know, trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and, you know, nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, you know, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, you know, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, you know, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, you know, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, you know, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, you know, some sort of, you know, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. But yeah, it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues. And one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims instead of the perpetrators.
There's a time bomb that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. Mm-hmm. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS...
Well, we'll just pause there for now. John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
you think that,
you know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean, I mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism and stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Latasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they haven't, they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force. The manner in which police always almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal bleeding.
I think what
and the police officers walked free.
Yeah, they walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial.
Of course. So, right.
And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice
system.
The
differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the black, as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the Black Power Movement, there are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the programme now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I mean, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and, nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which, mm-hmm. again, covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism. And it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إنما تكون الأشياء بإرادته ومشيته من غير كلام ولا تردد في نفس ولا نطق بلسان.
إمام الكاظم عليه السلام stated, Verily things come into being solely by his will and his wish, without the need for a speech, alternation of breath, or utterance with the tongue.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So when we're talking about the different conversations and the dialogues of the infallible imams, we find that it is very important to take these conversations from each infallible for every single infallible imam from among the 12 imams has these golden conversation and has this knowledge and wisdom and spirituality and advice which they put forth. And this advice and this knowledge and this wisdom is truly beneficial to every single one of us, even in the present day and age. Now, when talking about one of these specific conversations and these dialogues, we find that the divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim, peace be upon him, alayhi salam, was advising his son in one of these instances. And so Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam told his son to be earnest in his affairs and to be cautious of laziness. Now, when we are talking about being earnest in one's affairs, we're talking about being serious in one's affairs. And to take one's affairs seriously, to take one's duties seriously. And on the other hand, when we talk about being serious in accomplishing a duty, we are also talking about being cautious of being lazy. And so along these lines, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam spoke to his son and he said, "Beware of laziness and boredom, for they prevent you from your share in this world and the next." And how true is this, dear brothers and sisters? We find that both laziness, sluggishness, this kind of lethargic personality that sometimes we have, and this boredom, it really prevents us from so many things that we could accomplish. First and foremost, and the most immediate thing that this laziness and this lethargic behavior does is it prevents our share in this world. For example, we might not get up to study, we might not get up to go to school, we might be lazy in going to work, or at work we might be lazy in accomplishing certain things that we are supposed to be accomplishing. And so, of course, that share which we would be able to get in this world, we are prevented from getting because of laziness. And of course, the next one is the fact that this laziness and boredom and sluggishness and this lack of seriousness in our affairs, whether they be religious or extra-religious, they also prevent us from our share of the next world. For example, we might be lazy in doing our prayers, or we might be lazy in doing good deeds, or we might be lazy, for example, in another manner, and we might be lazy in preventing ourselves from committing sins, and thus we also lose the next world. And as a final thought, we find that Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he really opposed laziness, unemployment, and these kind of qualities because he said they lead to poverty and lowness and losing one's honor and decency. And so beware of laziness and boredom, dear brothers and sisters. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
A man by the name of Shaykh Al-Hanabila, not from the followers of the Ahl al-Bayt. His name was Abu Ali al-Khalal. He himself has written in his works that when I have a problem in my life, when I need something to be fulfilled, I go to the shrine of Musa ibn Ja'far and I ask Allah in the shrine of Musa ibn Ja'far, and it is indeed fulfilled. This is a fact and a realization that is demonstrated by hundreds and thousands, if not millions, on an annual basis. How many of you have seen recently the pilgrims that have flocked towards the city of Kadhimiyya within Baghdad, their intention to perform the ziyarah and to pay their respects to the imam known as Bab al-Hawa'ij, in requesting for their needs to be fulfilled and interceding using the name of the Imam so that Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala fulfills their needs and their desires.
Thank Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/EN. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.